Welcome to another edition of Lex Talk History, a podcast produced in collaboration with WUKY and the Lexington History Museum. Now, here's your hosts, Lexington History Museum Executive Director Mandy Higgins and WUKY's own Alan Lytle.
Yes, it is Lex Talk History for February. I'm Alan Lytle, of course. Mandy in the booth today. And wow, a lot of things happening at the museum, especially for February.
Yeah, February, you know, keeps us going and all of the things that we finally thought out. You can actually come and visit the museum, which is a big deal because it's been awful.
Yeah.
We still have the Harlan Hubbard exhibit on display. Great 12 panels, really beautiful. Come see that. We had a great President's Day. Number of folks coming out to experience the museum. Debuted some new children's activities, which were very fun, and will be available anytime you visit now. And unbelievable new acquisitions, Alan.
Yes, I can't wait to sort of get into this situation. You told us at a board meeting that, oh, by the way, we got this, and you got to tell everybody. It has to do with UK sports history.
It does, and there's nothing better than UK sports history, right? So right after Christmas, after the holidays, we got a call from a woman who was like, I have got some stuff from my grandpa. I don't know. Do you think you'd want it? And we were like, maybe. How's it relate to Lexington? What is it? Well, he was a three sports star at the University of Kentucky, and he graduated from Lexington High School, which is the precursor of Henry Clay. Absolutely. Please come see us. So she shows up at the museum with two totes of materials, and we're like, okay, cool.
We got some cleats in here.
Yeah, right. Yeah, what is this? Because she didn't really give us a time frame for when her... Knowing that he graduated from Lexington High, I knew it was the early 20th century, but we didn't have a real tight time frame. So she pulls out this huge piece of wool. And we were like, what is happening here? It is a 1912 UK football jersey, game worn, from Lynn Tracy, who was a three sports star, played at UK for... his time there, died in 1967, but this jersey still has Stolfield mud on it.
Oh my gosh.
And it's an unbelievable piece.
Yeah.
And her father had kept it, and she was moving out of Lexington and just felt like it should stay in Lexington. Then she's telling us, I think I have some, like, he ran track too, and I think I have some pieces from that, but I couldn't find him when I came. The football jersey had a pocket in it.
No.
And there were medals, track medals, in the pocket.
Wow.
She also had, and this, because we all know that I love basketball the most, the Lexington High School won some sort of international basketball competition while Lynn was a student there and on the basketball team. And he was awarded a watch and then a little basketball charm. And she had that as well. And so it's the University of Calgary in Canada, whatever basketball championship with his name and the number that he wore at Lexington High School. So it's a really incredible piece of Lexington memorabilia, but that chance to go and say, like, look at the ways things have changed.
Mm-hmm.
What football player in their right mind is going to put on a wool jersey?
It's going to itch, and it's going to sweat.
And you're
going to sweat a lot.
Heavy.
Yeah.
And it does have a must to it still. if you look up Lynn Tracy, if you Google him, the image that you see is him in the jersey, which is very cool.
The jersey
the
we're
jersey
talking about.
Wow. Well, I presume it's the jersey.
Yeah.
I don't think they got
They
many.
Probably didn't have to. Yeah. This is the one you get for the whole season.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah.
And it's stenciled just like U of KY, but not... You know, his name's not on it. There's the numbers in a spot that you couldn't really see it, which is just a fantastic little piece. And then to be able to make that connection to this was a local guy who, and you can see how sport has changed the university that at one point it really was like, okay, Lexington kids who are good at sports come and play on the college team and whatever. Well, today, maybe that happens in one in every 5,000 Fayette County high schoolers get a chance to play in a Division I school like the University of Kentucky. So it's just a really fun piece. We're so excited to be able to display it and more importantly, to preserve it, because sports history tells us so much about the city and what we're doing, and being able to go back more than a century for that is very cool. So any of you with connections to the University of Kentucky or Transylvania University sports.
Oh, we know we have lots of fans that listen to this show. Absolutely. So, yes.
Yeah. You know, Transy, at one point you had a football team. I need a jersey. Let's put it up against each other. It'd be great.
Well, was it Center College? They had a tremendous victory over Harvard.
Yeah, 6-0.
Yeah. So there is a football tradition in Kentucky.
Amazingly.
Yes. Wow. That is a great story to kick off our podcast for today. And so you've got plans to display this.
Yeah, it should be on display soon in the museum with a little card. We have to, you know, do all of our museum stuff first to make sure that it's preserved the way it needs to be, but it'll be on display and we'll be able to tell a little bit more of that story.
And people also, you got another Lex Talks coming up.
We
soon.
Do. So we have Driftwood, the Harlan Hubbard story and exhibit. Jessica Whitehead, who is the author of Driftwood, the autobiography of Harlan Hubbard, will be in Lexington on March 5th to talk about her book and how she put the exhibit together. She also is the curator at the Derby Museum. So if you have a burning horse question or Derby question, you can come
Derby's
see
Derby's coming
Jessica.
Up. Yeah.
Free event thanks to Traditional Bank, and that is March 5th at 6:30 at the museum.
Terrific. All right. Now we have a couple of very patient guests that we need to introduce as we get into the Let's Get Into It segment of our podcast.
Yes. I am so, so excited to have Dr. Amy Murrell Taylor and Steve Fan from Camp Nelson here with us to talk a little bit about the USCT, about work that we've done together, their work, all the things. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Very excited to be here, and I really enjoyed the intro with the football story.
Steve's a big football fan.
Well, when you talked about wearing wool, I immediately thought of the Civil War soldiers.
That's indeed. And I actually would love to wear a wool football jersey from like the early 1900s. I think that would be really cool.
Yeah. So tell our listeners a little bit about your work and what you do. You can do a better job of introducing yourselves than I ever would.
Well, thank you for having me, Mandy. My name is Steve Fan. I serve as the Chief of Interpretation at Camp Nelson National Monument down in Nicholasville, Kentucky, which is one of the newest units of the National Park Service. I've been a park ranger for almost 10 years now. It's kind of crazy how quickly that happens. I've worked at a lot of different national park sites, starting in Gettysburg in Pennsylvania, Richmond National Battlefield in Virginia, Stones River National Battlefield. I worked in D.C. for about 5 years for the Civil War Defenses of Washington. And I also worked at the Charles Young Buffalo Soldiers National Monument. And I had a really great opportunity to come to Kentucky to help develop a new unit of the National Park Service. I think a lot of people think of Camp Nelson as the National Cemetery. We're located directly north of it as the excuse me, historic site, which was a county park for about 20 years and then became a national park site in 2018. So it's a true privilege to be here. I'm originally from Denver, Colorado, so I never thought I'd end up in Kentucky, but you know, history takes you a lot of different places, right, Amy?
That's right.
Why I'm here.
And similarly, I'm not from Kentucky, originally from Rockville, Maryland, but this history is actually part of what drew me here. I'm a professor of history at the University of Kentucky, and I consider myself a historian of the South, and the era of the Civil War and Reconstruction have always been what's really grabbed my attention. There's so much you can learn from this really transformative moment in our past. And I would have to say that Camp Nelson and its history and some of the work that was done at the site going way back really piqued my interest in coming here when the University of Kentucky advertised a job. I mean, I was literally thinking, oh, I could actually have students do work on the ground. And I'm happy to say that dream has come true and have been involved in some really interesting projects with students.
And we've had several of your students work at the park.
Yeah.
As park rangers, as interns, they're helping us develop a lot of research and interpretive programs and projects and exhibits as well. including stuff that we're working with Mandy on. So it's been a really cool collaborative effort.
Yeah, well, you all have been so open, so thank you for that. But I think it's a history, as I'm sure you would say, is still so open to learning so much. So there's so much opportunity for students to dig in.
It is. I think compared to, if you think of the Civil War, you think of a traditional battlefield like Perryville, Richmond Battlefield, obviously Gettysburg, Vicksburg, Shiloh. There's so much scholarship on it, right? It's been researched and probably over-researched over the years, right? We know all the troop movements. There's not a ton of scholarship on places like Camp Nelson, right? Mm-hmm. These civilian and military sites that saw a lot of drama, triumph and tragedy, as we talk about at Camp Nelson. And it tells us a lot of who we are as people and how far we've gone and places we need to go, right?
For our listeners who maybe don't know as much about Camp Nelson's story, I am a Kentuckian, and I remember learning about Camp Nelson in high school when I was a Governor's Scholar. But the story was very different than it is today. It was really much more about being a military depot. So can you tell us a little bit about that beginning and how we think of Camp Nelson today?
Well, Mandy, I appreciate that perspective. You know, Amy and I come from different places, you know, and we're in Kentucky now, and I'm a trained Civil War historian. As I mentioned, I've worked at several Civil War sites managed by the National Park Service, and I never knew about Camp Nelson up until I moved out to Kentucky, really, in early 2021. I did a 4-month, what we call a detail here, and then I moved here permanently in September of 2021. And like a lot of things, especially west of like the Appalachian Mountains, it's kind of on the periphery of the Civil War studies, right? But especially a site like this, which was a U.S. Army supply depot and hospital, and really, I call it the crossroads. A lot of soldiers and civilians came together. And then it becomes, beginning in 1864, the largest recruitment and training center for African-American soldiers in the entire state, and the third largest in the country by the end of the Civil War. So that's dramatic, right? Over 10,000 African-American men, the majority of them enslaved, will seek freedom at places like Camp Nelson, right? And they'll be joined by their families as well, people escaping slavery, escaping war-torn areas as well. There's a lot of civilian unionists from like East Tennessee and other parts of Kentucky that also seek refuge at Camp Nelson. And that leads to Dr. Taylor's scholarship on focusing on African-American refugees, right, Amy? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wrote a book, Embattled Freedom, Journeys Through the Civil War's Slave Refugee Camps, and Camp Nelson figures really centrally to that story because it's a locally significant place. One of the men who fled there called it the first free spot of ground in Kentucky, but it's also a nationally significant place. I mean, when we think about the big emancipation story in the United States and how it proceeded over time, some of the events at Camp Nelson really accelerated the process of emancipation nationally. So that was something I was trying to capture in my work, but something that I just find so extraordinary about that site and its history.
Yeah, can you tell us a little bit about, so we know now that this is a site of freedom, but Camp Nelson was also a site of a lot of struggle. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about that interaction with civilians and military, some of the other maybe less celebrated pieces of that history?
Well, emancipation and freedom, I think we haven't fully appreciated in our society and our culture, was a process that had to be fought for every single day. It was much more of a grassroots struggle than our stories of, say, Lincoln granting freedom one day really tell. And so for those who were fleeing to Camp Nelson, they were initially doing it at a time in a Union state when U.S. policy was to turn them back. You know, this was a state that the Lincoln administration is trying to appease, especially its slave-owning class. And so while people may be fleeing to other parts of the South and the U.S. Army is allowing them in and offering them protection, initially it's not happening at Camp Nelson. And then it kind of gradually, the doors start to gradually open, but it is a struggle to push those doors open all along. And, you know, as Steve and his colleagues at Camp Nelson tell so well, it's especially a struggle for women and children to get inside the camp.
Yeah, thanks, Amy. I would add to that just by simply saying war changes things, right? And Lincoln is a native Kentuckian, right? He understands local politics very well. He wants to keep Kentucky and the border states in the Union. And so he takes a very conciliatory approach to how military and federal policies will impact the state. And a lot of Kentuckians hold on to that. They reference his inaugural speech in 1861, and after the Emancipation Proclamation comes out, which does not directly impact Kentucky, a lot of people feel betrayed by Lincoln and the administration, right? And that kind of sets the die is cast, I would say, right? Because the Emancipation Proclamation also authorizes enlistment of African American soldiers and sailors in the U.S. military. And you see this conflict in this state where the states try to control, you know, their laws and policies. The federal government is trying to respect that, but they also realize they're trying to win the war as well, right? And so this is going to be witnessed on a very personal level on the ground at places like Camp Nelson, right, where you have able-bodied men who enlist and free themselves. We call it self-emancipation. What about men, excuse me, what about men who are unfit for military service? What about men that are too old or young boys? What about women and children? They are not granted any sort of status beyond what they called refugees. And the government didn't have any policy, right, mm-hmm. I mean, with on how to deal with refugees. And so this is the triumph and tragedy part we talk a lot about, Mandy, right, where able-bodied men are able to free themselves and join the U.S. military and fight for their freedom and their rights of citizenship. But a lot of men join with the belief or the promise that they could take care of their families. And that was not the case. You know, on several occasions, almost a dozen times, African-American refugees were forcibly expelled from Camp Nelson. We call these the expulsions, including the wives and children of African-American soldiers. And Amy, you want to share a little bit more about this conflict here?
Well, this extends really late into the war. I mean, it's November 1864 when one of those worst expulsions happens that results immediately in the death of a soldier's child, more illness and death to follow, causes a national firestorm, really, if you look at the newspapers. I mean, there are headlines in New York and in California about the cruel treatment of the wives and soldiers of U.S. colored soldiers at Camp Nelson. And I think it's important to point out how late in the war this is. You know, that's November 64. The war ends April 1865. So it's that late, or another way to put it, like 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation has gone into effect. This is still being fought and contested in Kentucky.
And Mandy, with the national significance part, kind of building off Amy's points there, after the final expulsion in November of 1864, after this national outcry, I mean, it reaches the halls of Congress, mm-hmm. right? And it's a big deal. And I think about a place as small as Nicholasville, Kentucky, is being shared across the nation, right? This is, I guess the term we would use, it went viral, right? The U.S. Army will establish the Home for Colored Refugees at Camp Nelson and will provide housing and a school, a mess hall, a hospital, things to support African-American refugees. It will change policy, allowing freedom seekers to come into places like Camp Nelson, any military base across the country. They changed policy. And the national impact, March 3rd, 1865, Congress passes legislation which emancipates the wives and children of African-American soldiers. And this does not just impact African-Americans in Kentucky. It's across the country, right? And unsurprisingly, the Army sees an uptick in enlistment. That makes sense, right? And the Army is enlisting African-American men in Kentucky weeks after Appomattox, right? So we're talking late April into May of 1865. The African-Americans are still enlisting because they're freeing themselves and their families because slavery is still legal in the state.
Mm-hmm. Which is something I think a lot of people still don't know or realize, that for about 8 months, slavery was still legal in Kentucky after the Civil War until the 13th Amendment in December 1865.
And we have a timeline that talks about, you know, the Civil War from 1861 to 1865 and then beyond into Reconstruction literally until the 1970s. Because Amy talks about the 13th Amendment ratified on December 6, 1865. And to provide context with that, you know, Kentucky did not ratify that until 1976, as you know. And a lot of visitors are like, is that a typo there? Are you supposed to say 1876? We're like, no, that's 1976. And that provides quite a bit of context, mm-hmm. right? And so I think that's, we talk about a lot about that the process of emancipation, how difficult it is, that even after Lincoln's assassination, even after Lee surrendered at Appomattox, there are still people enslaved. Slavery is still legal in, you know, certain places in the country, all the way up until December 6th.
Yeah, and that's where some of the work that we've done together comes in. So obviously, Camp Nelson is actually in Jessamine County, not in Fayette, but Fayette is one of the largest enslaving counties in Kentucky. We know that Lexington-based soldiers enrolled at Camp Nelson, and the work that we got to do, that students got to do, followed them. Can you talk to us a little bit about that and what we hope
sure.
to get out of it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was so grateful when you, Mandy, and Steve, you know, came to me with this idea to get students more involved in the Lexington angle on this story. So about a year ago, really, we started, a little over a year ago, and students in a course I taught, an upper-level history course, they each tracked one Lexington-connected soldier. Maybe he was born in Fayette County, or maybe we had figured out that he ended up there. There was some connection. And it started out as really just a way to honor more of the people who fought for freedom from this area by telling their individual story. I mean, there's so much power in telling the story of an individual. And for my students, that was a very powerful thing. And so they dug, they, you know, looked at records from the National Archives and military records and newspapers and census records and local records at the courthouse and all of that kind of work. And what resulted were some pretty compelling individual stories. But I think there's also an interesting collective story that came out of it as well about Camp Nelson's connection to Lexington. Mm-hmm. And you can draw a straight line between the two, particularly when you think about what happens in this post-war period and the very common experience of migrating from Camp Nelson to Lexington. So that was a really, really compelling outcome.
And beyond, I would say, too, Amy, one of the, unfortunately, we don't know the soldier's name, but in late June of 1865, African-American soldiers and their families were organizing the very first Independence Day celebration for a lot of them outside of slavery, right? And they did it at the Home for Colored Refugees. And there was an observer who was visiting these African-American refugee and contraband sites across the country from England, and he records, you know, what happens here. John G. Fee there, the founder of Berea College, who's at the Home for Colored Refugees, is there. And apparently there are hundreds of people there, and, you know, they're supporting this celebration with food and money. There's going to be military parades and music and things like that. And apparently there's a sergeant major who stands up and makes a short speech about what Camp Nelson means to him. He's from Lexington, by the way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I like to use this story as an example that, you know, the path to freedom was not always north, right? We think of the Underground Railroad. People headed towards, like, the Ohio River and Canada and beyond. The path to freedom for a lot of enslaved people was anywhere they could go, right, where they could maybe take one step closer to freedom. And he makes the comment that it used to be 500 miles to Canada and freedom, but now it's only 17 miles, and it's Camp Nelson. So that's where he found his freedom, by marching down the road, right? Mm-hmm. And so that was really, really special to see people from all over this region, you know, go to places like Camp Nelson and Lebanon, all the way up to Louisville and beyond to seek their freedom. And a lot of people settled in Fayette County after the Civil mm-hmm. War, right? And so one of Amy's students that we had work with us over this last summer did a great work of tracing these veterans, right, Amy, mm-hmm. and who served in Camp Nelson units organized at Camp Nelson, excuse me. And, you know, I think Amy did it really well, because a lot of them had deeper records post-war, you know, including pension application and claims, right, Amy?
Right, yeah. That's, you know, one of the things that's interesting about studying the history of enslaved and freedom-seeking people during the Civil War era is that they come into contact with the federal bureaucracy, and that really transforms things archivally. They get recognized, they get documented. You know, finally we have a full name that's written down, whereas, you know, the census before the war didn't even write their names. So there's a record that's created not only by their service itself, but by their applications for post-war pension records. And those were really crucial when you look at those, which tend to be pretty autobiographical. I mean, in order to get a pension, a soldier or his widow have to share a lot about who they are, about their relationship. And, you know, if this is a formerly enslaved couple that was married, they didn't have a marriage certificate. Their marriage wasn't legalized until or recognized by law till after the war. So they have to really document a lot. So there's a lot in these records to draw from. And I think back to something you were saying, you know, what they're doing, what the students show is what these soldiers and veterans are doing in the post-war period was trying to make their freedom meaningful and tangible and concrete. And what comes out of their research is how much the focus then becomes land and a house. You know, we historians, we talk a lot about how Civil War service leads to citizenship and political rights. But there's a really interesting economic story. Mm-hmm. And the way in which many of these soldiers, it's pretty clear, were able to take their, you know, the pay they got during the war, the pension they got later, were able to save. And this becomes a really powerful vehicle for being able to acquire land. So that actually, I think, is a really important part of the story, and that this Lexington angle helps us to see is the way in which Civil War military service really not only transforms the economic lives of these families, but then transforms Lexington's neighborhoods.
Exactly. I was thinking, you know, one of the more powerful pieces that we saw when the students were presenting was Brucetown, right?
Yes.
There were a number of soldiers who returned to Lexington and settled as neighbors in Brucetown. And it's clear that we don't know for sure because it's not in the record, but it very much seems like they're using the same lawyer to go after their pension. Mm-hmm. They're talking to each other about how to do that.
Yeah.
And what struck me as a 20th century historian, so, you know, all of this is cool because it's not my specialty, was the voices of women in those pension records that we sought out to ask the students to follow USCT men who enlisted in the Army or the Navy. But often their stories are being told through their widows in pension records.
Right.
And it's not just a one-time piece, that it was that in itself, getting that pension was often a fight.
Right. Years. It took years, even decades. Mm-hmm. Some of these pension records are like 50 plus pages, right? And you can really trace the process that these families are going to, right, Amy?
Right. Well, and I remember some of the students were kind of shocked because here would be, say, a widow applying for a pension. She keeps getting turned down. She keeps going back. And when you stop and think about the work and the time, and as you say, having a lawyer, all of that, all they're investing in this process just tells you how important it is to them. Mm-hmm. That this potential for a pension payment could transform theirs and their family's lives. So there's a woman I remember from one of the stories. There was a soldier, Benjamin Wilson. He served in the 124th USCT enlisting at Camp Nelson. And he actually does not survive the war. His regiment ends up, or I can't remember exactly where he ended up, but he contracted an illness and died. And his wife, Elvira, applies for a pension and receives it. And that, along with her wages as a domestic servant, allows her to buy land in Prawltown. Mm-hmm. And the students figured out that that family stayed there at least three generations in that house, in that property. And, you know, what a powerful sort of illustration of what this military service could do mm-hmm. in helping that family get a foothold economically and start to build some wealth. You know, that's not the story we usually tell about this post-war period.
Right.
But it's happening. We can see that in the way that Lexington's Black neighborhoods are growing.
Yeah, I was going to say, Amy, I think the experience for African-American families post-war in Lexington can be a case study for a lot of these Freetown or black communities that are established across the state after the Civil War, right? Mm-hmm. We have the Ariel community at Camp Nelson, but there's a lot of communities, Huntertown, we talk about right in Versailles and Woodford County. There's a lot of communities, neighborhoods established in Louisville and then beyond. And I think that's what I see now. This is the national story, right? To show, I think there's this assumption, right? Maybe it's the late 1800s or the 1920s or 30s where we have this great migration of African Americans. This is happening after the war as well, right? Either they're coming to places like Lexington or Nicholasville or a lot of places throughout central Kentucky, or they're going much farther than that, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. They are. I mean, many of these families stay here in the Lexington hamlets or in neighborhoods. But we also find that some by the late 1870s are leaving Kentucky and migrating to Kansas mm-hmm. in what, you know, is called the Exodus. They were exodusters. They were looking for the promised land because the very fact that they're gaining this economic toehold and these political rights really it invites backlash it doesn't invite it, but the backlash comes, and that kind of progress is something that many white Kentuckians cannot tolerate. They've done a lot to try to prevent people from buying land. They've done a lot to try to prevent people from voting, and yet we still see these veterans and their peers are still progressing. But eventually the violence gets overwhelming for many, and Kansas becomes the answer.
I think that's such a powerful piece, too, from the students of seeing them be able to track folks back to Lexington and then tracking them beyond and having to grapple with, mm-hmm. well, they came here for a little while,
yeah.
but why wouldn't you stay? Or what is the difference between this family staying in Pearltown for three generations and another family that couldn't get their pension or couldn't
right.
have access to that piece of property, and so they keep moving? I think it helps us think about Lexington in so many different ways, and for students to have that local piece is so powerful.
Yeah, and I think some of them would be shocked that, oh, this happened right where the university
yes.
is.
Right.
Yeah.
So Pearltown,
right.
for example, or Adamstown mm-hmm. is an even better example. I mean, that's founded in 1872, and we've got veterans and their families and others. I'm not saying that it's only military families, but others as well. And that is now the site of Memorial Coliseum mm-hmm. at UK.
I remember there was one of the pension records, and then the student looked into property records and things like that as well. And it's incredibly tragic, right? I mean, 40 or 50 years after the Civil War, these families are still struggling to own property, mm-hmm. to get a mortgage that would not basically destroy their finances,
yeah.
right? And there was one account of us, I believe the soldier had passed away and his widow was getting a pretty small pension. And before he passed away, he was able to get a mortgage, but it was a really bad deal, right? High interest rate. The family had to pay a certain amount back within a year. He passes away. They couldn't do it because she was still trying to get her pension raised, right? At least a few more dollars. And they ended up having to leave the house, right? They had to mm-hmm. sell and mm-hmm. probably didn't make much back from it, right? Mm-hmm. And this is right before World War I, mm-hmm. right? I mean, so the impact of this is generational, I would say.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, they didn't have banks that were loaning to them. These mortgages you're talking about are just kind of random people in the community with money who say, yeah, I'll give you a loan, but here are these outrageous mm-hmm. terms. You know, the Freedmen's Savings Bank is trying to gain a toehold nationally, but it would really struggle itself, particularly after the Great Panic of 1873. So, you know, those kinds of details, those parts of the story, I think are really instructive because, as you say, sometimes the difference is in the small details. Like they just needed this much more or needed a much better, you know, interest rate, and they could have made it. I mean, this is how precarious the story is.
When I think of the hamlets particularly, you know, for a while, the city told the story, the city historians told the story of the hamlets of good white people giving land to formerly enslaved individuals that they enslaved on that property. And thanks to this work and to Miss Giles and to so many other people, we know that they were mortgaged.
Mm-hmm.
That land was bought.
Yes.
With pensions, with pooling money from those former enslavers.
That's where I think this is the history that hasn't been told so well. That, you know, we have in the national picture the story of this is the era when the federal government betrayed freed people. The federal government did not break the land monopoly of white landowners and make land available. But, you know, there is that story and that's important. But freed people didn't wait for the federal government to become landowners.
Right.
They kept going. And so this is a story of all the various complex ways they strategized and saved and figured out how they could do it anyway. And they did. It's not an easy story. But I think it's really one we have to keep telling.
And they're still there. Right. The legacy is very, very deep. The living legacy, we talk a lot about descendants, right? But just here in Lexington itself, and you just mentioned Yvonne Giles and the brilliant work she's done over decades here. And I think of African Cemetery Number 1 and the number of soldiers, veterans that are buried there that lived in the same neighborhood after the war. They knew each other. These men and families knew each other, right? Mm-hmm. And I see that down at the Camp Nelson area, our post-war community area, now known as Hall. There's a small black cemetery very close to where the Home for Colored Refugees used to be during the war, and then this black community after the war. And there was, I'm trying to remember, at least a dozen veterans that are buried there that were in the U.S. Colored Troops. And one of our rangers who got her PhD at UK and is a brilliant researcher, she was tasked with researching the people that were buried at the cemetery, right? The names we had. And it was very powerful. And I thought it was special, right? Because it puts a human story and name. And there are, as I mentioned, about a dozen soldiers. And they're like, so-and-so served in this regiment. And he married so-and-so, who was also buried here. That's his brother-in-law. They were like a large family, right? And there was a lot of soldiers that had served with each other that married each other's like sisters, you know what I mean? And the legacy kind of continued for well over 2 to 3 generations, right? And I see that with the work that Yvonne did, has been doing, you know, at places like African Cemetery Number 1 and throughout Fayette County. You see these communities forming, as you mentioned, these people knew each other. And then, you know, when they passed away, they're buried together, right? The number of U.S. Colored Troops at that cemetery is incredible. It's like 150 now, and they're dedicating headstones every single year, right? That story, when the intern was working with all three of us, she kept on mentioning, I'm like, so what happened to this person? Passed away, buried at African Cemetery Number 1. And then the next soldier, buried at African Cemetery Number 1, right? And it just kept on adding up, and it really paints the picture.
Yeah. You mentioned Yvonne Giles, and I just want to take a minute as a shout out to so many local historians who've been doing this work for years in various ways, who our students consulted with and who really helped the students. Yvonne Giles at Cemetery 2 is one of them. And Shay Brown in the county clerk's office. He's the deputy clerk.
Right. Yeah.
Raynette Jones in UK Special Collections. You know, we're just kind of advancing, or the students are really advancing so much that's been done already. This is a great place to work with so many brilliant, energetic people who are really devoted to this history.
Couldn't agree more. The work that the foundation that they built on and the work that they're doing is incredible. And we hope eventually to be able to have this as an exhibit that folks can engage with and learn a little bit more about the individuals that the students researched and then be inspired to continue that.
Mandy, I'll share real quickly. The work is already being featured, right? We had this really cool kind of story map interactive exhibit, which includes these post-war communities. And it was the intern that shared this research that she had uncovered that is featured literally in the exhibit, which is incredible, right? And it's a thing that we're going to continue to add to, right? Because every single day, as we're talking about Amy, we're learning more and more about the people that are connected to this area, obviously the U.S. Colored Troops and their families. And we're finding stories of communities of people that are, I just learned recently, the superintendent and I went to Simmons College of Kentucky in Louisville, right? Mm-hmm. the state's first historically black college and university, established by Elijah Mars and his brother, who were USCT veterans who were in a Camp Nelson regiment. I didn't realize this, and I was talking with a local historian. Her name is Juanita White, and she's like one of the leading historians when it comes to Louisville, especially the African-American experience. She did a lot with the Simpsonville site and for the 5th U.S. Colored Cavalry there. And she had mentioned, I didn't realize this because I knew about Elijah Mars, but the first three presidents of Simmons College were USCT veterans. Mm-hmm. And I was like, how did I not know that, right? And these are nationally significant role. They were involved in some big battles, and then post-war they were critical to the establishment of this new institution, right? It just shows you the impact these people had.
Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of them. I mean, look at the numbers. Kentucky had the second largest number of black men who enlisted in the U.S. Army. 57% is what I've heard of men, black men of military age served from Kentucky. So, I mean, that's a pretty broad segment of the population. So they're destined to have an impact in some of the ways that you're talking about.
Mandy, I know you, obviously this focus is Fayette County and Lexington, right, and the experiences of these people, soldiers and their families and their descendants. I do want to make the point to your listeners, to everyone here in Kentucky, that this story is nationally significant, right? We talked about this before. Kentucky's story and history is nationally significant. There are USCT soldiers that I have found that are buried like literally across the country, right? I found some at a national cemetery in New Orleans when, you know, some of these Camp Nelson soldiers were sent out to Texas to serve and, you know, we're going through New Orleans. We're actually working this next weekend, or literally tomorrow, with Nicodemus National Historic Site, which is an MPS site. We're working with Boston African American National Historical Park, George Washington Carver National Monument, and the Kansas African American Museum. And we were sharing this on our social media page that we're doing this really cool collaborative program because, 7,000, right, Amy, black Kentuckians went west mm-hmm. after the Civil War in the 1870s. And this is the most humbling part. Three descendants commented that, hey, I'm a descendant of a USCT soldier that from Kentucky that went west. One of them lives in Texas. One of them lives in Maryland. And another one, I can't recall, but we pulled up all the service records and we'll be featuring the soldiers' stories and their families on Saturday, right? So this shows you how relevant it is today, if that makes sense. So for me, that's, I always find that inspiring that we hear from, you know, descendants that are literally spread across this country, right? That shows mm-hmm. you how national this really is.
I think so. Can you, for our listeners who have not had the pleasure of coming to Camp Nelson, can you tell them a little bit about hours and access?
Well, you know, we're, as I mentioned, one of the newest units in the National Park Service. And as I mentioned, I think a lot of people confuse us with the National Cemetery. There was a cemetery there during the Civil War. Camp Nelson was this large military base that was like over 4,000 acres. And after the war, what was called Cemetery or Graveyard Number 2 becomes a national cemetery. So for people in the community, when they think of this, Camp Nelson as a national cemetery, it makes sense, right? It's been an active military cemetery for over 100 years, right? Today, the cemetery is managed by the Department of Veteran Affairs. We work very closely with them. But directly north is Camp Nelson National Monument. Now run by the National Park Service. We've got like a visitor center and museum there, reconstructed barracks, remnant earthworks that were built by enslaved people, including men who later joined the U.S. Colored Troops, about 5 miles of trails. The grounds are open every day, sunrise to sunset, and the visitor center is currently open Wednesday through Sunday, 9 to 5. Come in and see us. We'd love to show you all around. It's a free, no entry, no fee park. You can come in anytime. We do a lot of special programming and events there. On the 21st, one of our UK graduate who works with our staff is going to be presenting for the winter lecture series. Amy's presented there before about women who were at Camp Nelson, right? There was not just soldiers there, but there were civilians, including women employed to work for the government and the Army at Camp Nelson. So a lot of special things coming down at Camp Nelson National Monument. So we looked forward to having y'all down there. It's funny, I was talking to one of the staffers today that welcomed me into the building, and we were chatting, and he's been to a lot of national park sites, and I told him I was in D.C. before this. He's like, why Kentucky? And I get that up from a lot of my friends, and I'm like, Camp Nelson, that's why I'm here. So thank you so much. I appreciate it.
We're so glad that you're here. And if you want to learn a little bit more about those events, you're very active on social media. The website has it.
Yeah, just look up Camp Nelson National Monument. I always tell people, look for the MPS arrowhead, right? Mm-hmm. And we've got a Facebook page, as you mentioned. We have an Instagram page. We post all of our events, which are always free and open to the public, on our pages. And we've got a lot of really cool stuff coming up this next summer. And we're doing events all over the area, including up at Green Hill Cemetery in Frankfort, which mm-hmm. has a USCT monument. There's dozens of African-American soldiers buried there, including USCT soldiers. We're doing like a reef ceremony there. We'll be doing a sunset program at Huntertown Community Interpretive Park, a post-war community established by USCT veterans. Just as an example of some of the things that we're going to be working on this next summer, and all the dates will be on our website and social media pages. Come out and see us.
Thank you all so much for joining us. This has been incredible.
Oh, yeah. What a great conversation. And again, these are stories that have kind of flown under the radar, and it's, you know, our task to elevate them in any way that we can.
Thank you for giving us the opportunity to do that here today.
Yeah, we're very honored to be here. And, you know, I would just like to echo what Amy just said there. It's a privilege to be here, and y'all are doing amazing work. And I assume a lot of the people that listen are, you know, locals in Fayette County. This is really incredible, inspired history, and that not only Kentuckians should be proud of, but all Americans as well. So appreciate the opportunity, and hope to see y'all soon.
Oh, and we have to plug that book, Embattled Freedom.
Yes. Oh, thank you.
Go out and get it. It's great.
It's
great.
Actually one of the best sellers at the park. Every time we sell a book, I text Amy and be like, hey, I just chipped into your beach house. And
I wish.
Yeah. And on the cover of the book is what, Amy?
A picture of the Camp Nelson Home for Colored Refugees.
Yes, so
a photograph, actually incredible photograph.
So the connection's deep. And we sell the book at the park. Shameless plug there, but come and see us, okay? So
everybody's always got something to plug, including
yes.
us.
Yes.
We've got the March Lex Talk
yes.
history.
Please, you know, after you go to Camp Nelson and learn a little bit more about all of the great things there, think about coming to the museum on March 5th at 6:30 to hear from Jessica Whitehead. Her book will be for sale that evening, and she'll tell us a little bit more about Harlan Hubbard and her all of the work she's done to uncover his legacy throughout Kentucky.
And when is the museum open?
Yes, you can come visit us Thursdays and Fridays, 12 to 4, and Saturdays, 10 to 4, or by appointment. $10 general admission, group rates, all kinds of things. We'd love to see you. Please come out and learn a little bit more about Lexington.
Can I coax out of you what we're going to be doing in March?
Yes, March is so fun. All of these are fun, and we get really poignant and really important stories, and then we get really fun pieces. And March
not
is,
that you guys weren't
not,
fun.
You all were awesome.
You were very, very fun.
March yeah. is the original organized, some of the earliest organizers of the St. Patrick's Day Parade in Lexington, which is a very different but
yeah.
related experience.
Erin Gobra.
So the museum has one of those other really cool new acquisitions. The museum has just taken in some scrapbooks, photographs, and a couple of artifacts from the original organizer of the St. Patrick's Day Parade and Festival, who passed recently. So the legacy is being carried on by our guests in March.
All right. Now, if we have green beer, it's got to be non-alcoholic on these properties.
Yeah. Well, you know, we'll see what we can do. We'll see what we can do.
Always like to end on a lighter note. Well, we've had a great time with this conversation. And thanks again for joining us today. And we will see you next month on Lex Talk History.
You've been listening to Lex Talk History, a monthly podcast produced in collaboration with WUKY and the Lexington History Museum. Subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts, or download Lex Talk History from the podcast page at WUKY.org. And if you haven't done so already, please make plans to visit the Lexington History Museum soon. Get started on your tour at lexhistory.org.